So hi everybody, welcome to this week's CV Focus for ITTHub.net. We're going to go off on a little bit of a different tack this week. We've focused in the last sort of previous issues very heavily on vehicle manufacturers and the likes. But manufacturers have got their own dealer network, and the dealers are probably the heartbeat of the commercial vehicle industry, logistics industry, whichever way you want to look at it. And there's been a lot of, I'm sure everybody's aware, there's a lot of bad news about at the minute. But well, let's have some good news. Now, I was lucky enough to be invited to a grand opening of a brand new dealership on the outskirts of, adjacent to Heathrow Airport, an organisation called AGS, and that's Automania Garage Services. Now, I was so impressed. I've seen lots and lots of truck dealers all around the world. I thought, we've got to get these people on a podcast. So joining me is Paul McGurty, who's joint MD of the AGS business. Hi, Paul, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm all good, thank you. Not too bad at all.
Impressive. I was really, really impressed with what we saw last week. Now, the brand you represent on that site is Mercedes-Benz.
Yes.
But it's... Tell the story, Paul. I mean, tell us about the investment. Tell us what's gone into it. And importantly, tell the listeners why you are located in such a, I suppose, an important area of London.
Well, historically, before we got involved with Mercedes-Benz, we've effectively been an airport-related service provider, if you like. So the way I look at it is, if you sat on a plane and then you see a vehicle coming up to either to load food or to get people on the airplane, whether it be in wheelchairs, etc., we've historically sort of serviced and maintained those vehicles for numerous customers, whether it be catering customers, whether it be airport cleaning customers. And that's our history. So our history was literally just support and maintenance. And our specialism in that area was effectively whereby a vehicle would go down, we would have sometimes minutes to repair it, sometimes hours. So we operated in very strict service level arrangements, if you like, or agreements with them. And what happened was, one of our key customers on the airport invested heavily in a Mercedes-Benz fleet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking ill of any dealers or service network in the past, but our airport SLAs are far stricter, or far more stringent than the main dealers. So when they invested in 140, 150 trucks of Mercedes-Benz vehicles, they said, look, love the vehicle. Mercedes-Benz are a great product, which myself and Richard agree. It is, but we can't put it in the dealership network because, again, we might need airside cover.
Richard being the joint manager,
and then that sort of started the conversation with Mercedes-Benz, saying, okay, we want to maintain these vehicles, we want to look after these vehicles, but we're not a Mercedes-Benz franchise. And that's sort of how it sort of grew from that point, getting the relationship going, having a conversation with Mercedes-Benz, saying, look, there's an opportunity on the airport. And then the investment conversation happened. So we went looking to move, but when the site came available near Heathrow, obviously pre-COVID, we all thought, let's have a go. And it made sense because there's hundreds and thousands of vehicles on Heathrow Airport, which whether it be Mercedes, which need maintaining, which aren't currently in the dealer network. And we want to try and bring that SLAs that we have to the airport, to the main commercial logistic marketplace. So again, if a vehicle comes into us, it will be serviced there and then. You won't have to ring up and wait 2 to 3 weeks. And it just allowed us to sort of widen that service levels that we have in the airport to the general commercial marketplace. And where we are now on the Bath Road, right by Heathrow, it allows us to do that because effectively we've got the airport over the road, which is key, which is an industry in itself. And we've got the M25, the M4, the M40 within minutes away. So we want to try and have that sort of service level arrangement, if you like, both to commercial clients and aviation clients. And every time you speak to people who buy trucks and buy vans, it's not the product that's ever the problem. So, obviously I'm here to sell Mercedes-Benz, but to be fair, Volvo trucks are good, Scania trucks are good. It's not the product, it's how they're maintained afterwards. And we feel by the situation we have, the geography of our garage, the service level ranges we have and the skill set we have, we can ensure that the vehicles are off the road for as little as possible. And the location we have to the airport and the motorway just facilitates that. So we've invested about 6 million quid in total onto the facility, which is 65,000 square foot-ish, which is about the size of a football pitch, which is sort of one of the biggest garages in the country, but certainly in terms of facility-wise, one of the best facilities, I'm bound to say this, that I think is around. 30-odd pits, electric charging stations, our own substation, solar panels on the roof to feed the electric vehicles for the future, and obviously a skill set of staff, which is, I think, second to none. Mm.
It's fascinating times. I mean, we've spoken a lot on the various CV Focus podcasts about electric vehicles. But it's quite interesting what you were saying there. I mean, obviously, you probably know better than anybody else what, I suppose, your largest customer, your next door neighbour, Heathrow Airport's aspirations are for becoming, I suppose, carbon neutral or carbon zero or certain region. How did you interface with that? How does that work?
So a few years back, Heathrow had a 2020 policy, which is by 2020, 20% of its fleet was meant to be electric or green, if you like. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that is just a barometer of the general sort of, political network around London in particular, with the mayor, whether it be the congestion charge, the low emission zone. And it is an opportunity for us going forward, whereby they have to invest a lot in their fleet. There's two key problems with electric vehicles. One is the cost up front, but two, and the main problem is the infrastructure, because once you analyse the cost, you'll get it back over the life of the asset, because it's far cheaper to run an electric vehicle than a road-going vehicle or a diesel vehicle. But the key issues is the serviceability and the infrastructure. So by us having that specialist sort of garage nearby, it facilitates a customer effectively investing in the electric vehicle, because they'll have no issues that there's a charging point nearby. They'll have no issues that the vehicle will be serviced, because ultimately going forward, everything is green credentials. So the low emission zone is extending itself around Heathrow Airport. And the Mayor of London is obviously keen to push the green, the carbon neutrality of the whole area. I think the new runway is a long way off now because of COVID. I know it was pushed back, but I actually felt it would have come through, because as much as you shouldn't say this, it's an economical force, Heathrow, and it generates jobs. Yeah. So that third runway would have really generated jobs, but obviously COVID pushed that back. But I think one way for it to come through in the future would be for the next runway to be completely carbon neutral. And that means all the GSE equipment on the airport to be green, and all the support vehicles to be green. And the only way to do that at the moment is going to be electric. Yeah. So we need to have an infrastructure in place with Heathrow, with the Mayor of London, with the low emission zone, all to be electric. And if you go around the airport, you know, everyone focuses on the planes in the sky, but when you go down that Bath Road or the A4, the logistics and the freight and the couriers and what we call the last mile, there's hundreds of thousands of jobs and hundreds of thousands of businesses around there. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they're all going to have to be electric, whether it be electric vans, trucks, buses, etc. Mm-hmm. It's something that we saw as an opportunity for us to go
at. Do you think... I mean, obviously, what we're going through with COVID at the minute is decimating businesses and decimating industries. But do you believe this? I mean, obviously, there possibly some positives to come out of it. Are people really, really focusing and hastening the decision with electric vehicles?
I'd like to think so. I think what COVID has done, though, is put pressure on everyone's cash flow. So obviously an electric vehicle might be 20 to 30% more upfront. I think it's had positives and negatives. So what COVID has done is focus people on how businesses run. You know, we've done the same. You know, I think we've all, because everything's been so good the last few years, we've all had some fat on our back, which we didn't need. So I think there will be some natural casualties, which isn't a great thing to say, but ultimately business is going to get leaner. So I think there'll be some negatives, some job losses, which you've already seen, some businesses running in different ways. But I think maybe the positive on COVID is, because everything's sort of concertinaed so quickly together, we might miss out that next step and get straight to electric. Because people might actually think, you know what, I'm not going to do another investment round of diesel vehicles. I'm going to go straight to electric, because ultimately it is the future. I can be seen to have a good corporate social responsibility strategy. I can be seen to be green. And the way for the business to come back is to be, you know, future proof, if you like. So I think it will accelerate people's minds on how businesses are run and hopefully, you know, the electric. The key issue we have, again, is serviceability, which we think we can cover. The next bit in terms of costs will be the manufacturers, but also the government. You know, an electric truck is, you know, around Heathrow would be perfect, but you can buy a diesel chassis for 70, 80, 90 grand. Electric equivalent's probably going to be 140, 150 when they come out. Yeah. Maybe a little bit less, but everyone's a bit unsure. That's a huge gap. And ultimately, it's the customer who has to fund that gap at the upfront. So when you do your cost of life asset over 10 years, not a problem. Electric's much cheaper, but you've still got to fund that upfront sum. And I think that's the issue at the moment. The people are hesitant, that extra 20, 30, 40% cost upfront, that's got to be funded at a time when COVID, you know, look at the lockdowns. You know, we when lockdown happened in the end of March, we thought we'd be out of it in 3 or 4 weeks. We're now 6 months in. And I think that makes people nervous to invest.
Yeah, it's a really valid point you make there, because as I said, I mean, because obviously the ITT Hub event is very much focused about emerging technologies and future technologies. And I think from what you're saying, it sort of balances the books a little bit, because you're right, it's probably an aspiration that people want to achieve. Yeah. But there's a cost to it, isn't it? And I suppose sort of slick finance packages sort of that would make people sort of jump. I must admit, and I am an advocate of, I think, particularly in the part of the country where you're trading from, and in particular the area, you know, with emissions from both aircraft and vehicles, there has been sort of significant improvements in things like air quality. And I think, I can't speak for local government, I can't speak for local councils, and I think probably, I mean, you had the mayor of Hillingdon at your event the other week, and he's probably more qualified to comment than I am. But there's going to be certain environmental benefits that the local taxpayer wants to keep on top of.
Yeah, no, definitely. Everything's a conflict. It's very tricky, and you know, you mentioned the slick finance packages, and we obviously don't do that. But you try and come up in your head of a way for manufacturers to make it more accessible, and it's a very strange sort of analogy. But you know, when people get solar panels on the roofs of home, they almost pay for it over the life of the asset. So saying that, you know, we were thinking to give customers an opportunity to invest. Say a diesel truck is 80 grand, and an electric truck's 140. Well, the customer pays 80 up front, but maybe 40 is financed over the life of the asset. So they're almost getting the saving as the saving over the diesel cost and the other bits and bobs they're paying for it, because it's so tricky. It really is. It's a really hard thing to do, particularly with electric vehicles, because the other issue we have is, you know, we have to invest in electric vehicles. So we have this conundrum in our head. It's the residual value as well. So again, from a commercial operator, whether you have an operated license or people like us who maintain vehicles, if we go and invest in an electric vehicle, which is 30% more expensive than a diesel version, and we own it for 5 years, what's the residual value? The way technology changes at the moment, that I think that pushes away people, because you know, in terms of everyone expects an asset to be able to be resold on. With electric vehicles, what's the resale market? Right. And again, I think COVID's focused people's minds on that, because there's been so many surplus assets about, and the residual values have gone down so low. You know, people can't churn fleet the same way.
It's really interesting talking to you about this, because, as I say, you're, as much as you are sort of joined at the hip, I would say, with a vehicle manufacturer, you're very much coming at it from an operator perspective, you know. You know, you really are looking at the sort of pros and cons and what you've got to put yourself in their head, haven't you?
You've got to, and again, I'm not speaking ill of any other manufacturer, but you know, I think Mercedes-Benz are realizing now that all dealers and manufacturers have had some arrogance, thinking that the product is the best. But in reality, the product is, it doesn't matter what operators want. Is a vehicle that doesn't break down, it doesn't matter. I'm bound to sell the three-pointed star, as you say, but it doesn't matter if you've got a three-pointed scar or a scanning on the front. It's the cost and how it's utilized. But that has to come from an operator's point of view. So you've got to lose the arrogance, and you've got to have your sales focus based on, what if I was running that vehicle? And all those things matter. So what's the VORs? What's the cost to maintain the vehicle? What's the residual value in 5 years' time when I flog it? All those things come into play. And we have to address it now, otherwise the market will stagnate. I really believe that.
There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. I mean, obviously, I'm still quite interested about, obviously, the support for the electromobility, for electric vehicles. Yeah. Now, that will, I mean, obviously, the way that you've gone about this is, you're future-proofing your business, aren't you?
So we've invested about £1 million of our £6 million investment is electric focused, if you like, in terms of the way the pits are done, the ramps where the positioning are to get to the batteries. We've got the overhead gantries, we've got our own substation. So you have to look at that basis. And again, and I'm sort of going off on a tangent a bit, but uh-huh. I'm an accountant by trade, so I'm not a mechanic whatsoever. And when I first heard about electrics, I was thinking, well, that's going to rob our work effectively, because you think as a mechanic, you need a dirty diesel vehicle. You don't. In reality, electric vehicles requires a different skill set, but it's just as much. You still sell as many hours from a garage point of view, but it is a different skill set with a different tooling and specialism required.
And I suppose the location, I mean, obviously, I suppose the main focus is, again, around the vehicles that are going to be in at Heathrow Airport, just because of your geographical location and probably an appetite for electric vehicles to be running in and out of the city, you're going to probably sweep up on some of that business as well.
Hopefully. I mean, and the airport vehicles, again, going back before I got involved in this business, an airport vehicle reminds me of an ice cream van when I was a kid. The engine's running for 15 hours, but it goes 10 miles a day, you know, and that's absolutely perfect for electrification. Diesel engines are the worst thing. The engine's running for 10, 12 hours a day. It does 10 miles a day. It's bad for the engine, bad for the environments, and bad all around. But an electric vehicle can be sat there, only in power as and when it's needed, one charge per day, no issues over emissions. You don't have to regen the engine every week because it's just sitting there doing nothing. Electrification is perfect for airport related business because they do, it's high usage but low miles.
Yeah.
And when I say high usage, most of it's just sat there, and it's they're sat there with the engines running, and that's the worst thing for the environment and for a vehicle.
Now I think I know the number, but I'm not going to say it. I'm going to ask you to tell me it. I know if a vehicle is attached to an aircraft and the vehicle fails, there's quite hefty penalties imposed on that vehicle operator, isn't there?
There is. It can, depending on sort of who you're dealing with, it can be thousands, to be fair, for minutes, yeah. So we have,
a minute.
Again, going back to our service, yes, we have a service level agreement, which again, we want to try and bring to the commercial operators. So we have what we call a red call, which we have to be there within 15 minutes. Because literally, if a plane is delayed, it could be thousands. And that doesn't come directly to us. It comes through the chain. So it'll come from the airline to the freight manager through to then us as a maintenance provider. Yeah. So again, yeah, we need to be there within minutes and either move that vehicle, fix that vehicle. Quite often with planes, to get them off, you literally just drag the vehicle off, and then you'll repair it later on. But yeah, within 15 minutes for a red call, we need to be there, remove the vehicle, done. Otherwise, there's significant fines, which, you know, you can understand because when Heathrow Airport's shut, I think I read somewhere a little while back, it's a couple of million quid every hour that it's shut, isn't it, in terms of the lost trade in and out of the country and stuff, so.
Yeah. I mean, so you're coming at it from a completely different angle, really, than that. You mean the sort of the service level agreements or arrangements you've got in place, gradually, as you say, you wanted to introduce, cascade that down to sort of to road transport.
Definitely. Because again, you know, everything's got tighter over the last few years, even pre-COVID, and you know, people are running fleet levels with less fat on them. So, you know, it could be like 2-4% of the vehicles off the road at any given time, and that requires tighter SLAs, and that can only be done with us operating our airport-based experience effectively. It's just the only way it can be done. So again, you know, we need vehicles to be serviced. Yeah, we're not unique in this overnight, but we need vehicles to be serviced on the day. You can't have, which I know happens in other places, people ringing up, say, I want a vehicle service, or bring us back in 10 days, or bring the vehicle in 10 days. We will do it on the day, collection, delivery, courtesy cars. It's the only way that these tight fleets now in the logistics and operational sectors can work.
Yeah, because it's dead easy to forget. I mean, obviously, am I correct? Is it about 2,500 vehicles run at Heathrow?
I think it's actually slightly more, but around that mark, yeah.
There's thousands of vehicles more, probably very rarely leave the sort of perimeter fence. And it's a complete industry within its own right, isn't it? And that's what, I suppose, ultimately, that's what fascinated me about being able to have a chat to you about it.
Yeah, it's a mini city. It really is. You know, if you look at the infrastructure and drive around in terms of the, you know, and this is where I get sort of frustrated, if you like, and when I went on to LBC and talked about it, the number of job losses, it's its own mini economy. And obviously COVID is not with anyone's control, but how we manage the situation is, and it's huge. So there is more than 2,500 vehicles. There's a lot more. We have clients who have 600 alone, 700 alone vehicles just on themselves. But the number of jobs are massive, and Heathrow is a powerhouse. The economy is massive. You know, everything flows through there, you know, whether it be logistics, freight, tourism, as was before COVID, business. It's so important. I think I read somewhere, you know, there's over 100,000 direct jobs and hundreds of thousands of other jobs. You know, you literally drive down the Bath Road, all those hotels, you know, there must be 50 hotels on that Bath Road. Yeah. There must be 100,000 jobs in them alone, with the cleaners, with the chefs, with the managers, etc. It's so dependent.
And I suppose out of any businessman or business person, I should say, in Britain, you're probably one of the most qualified to comment on COVID-19 and how we as a country sort of steer commercially through it, I suppose. And what's the light at the end of the tunnel? What do we need to do, in your opinion, Paul? Do we need to do to make things work?
It's very, very tricky, isn't it? Because you've got people all over the world trying to come up with these ideas. So this is just my waffles as normal, but it's confidence, isn't it? So it's obviously not going away. You can see the cases rising in the UK, France, yeah. Spain.
Part of the northeast of England shut down today.
Yeah, so it's how you deal with it. And I think it can only come from giving people confidence, but within very clear restrictions. And I'm not on about sort of state rule type thing, but, you know, there needs to be, clear route on testing at the airports. There needs to be clear understanding. With the whole quarantine system, if it's that bad, shut the borders completely. You know, you can't operate 1 week open, 1 week shut, because that doesn't breed confidence in life, never mind industry or holidays. So we need to have clear testing at the airport, clear testing the other side, a passport for travel, which I think other countries do have. And, you know, you shouldn't be able to leave that airport or enter that airport if you think you're going to test positive. Yeah. And then there needs to be that slickness. And then it can be managed. Because then you know you're only sat on a plane, or you sat in a car, or you sat on a bus with someone who's clean, yeah, in terms of a COVID test. And if you're not, then you're not in that situation. But it needs to get there pretty quick, because another lockdown just doesn't work. And I'm saying that from a selfish point of view, but from a wider point of view, whether it be my family, my friend, you know, the whole life, you know, another lockdown just can't come to the country, because it isn't going to go away. All lockdown's done is just delay this again. We've had a lockdown, cases go down, and then we're back to where we are. So another lockdown just literally staggers everyone along a little bit longer until we die again. Mm. You know, it's a real tricky situation. So it has to be confidence, control, and a structure. And again, going back to quarantine thing, I don't think it should be here at all if we're tested correctly. But if it's bad, as the government says, shut everything. Because I don't see why I can go to Greece, ignore the rule of six, and come back to England. Yeah. It just doesn't make sense. I'm not criticising the government, but it just doesn't make sense. I don't see how my kids go to a big school. There's 1,800 kids, so they go to school with 1,800 people and then come home and have to observe the rule of six. It's a complete contradiction. If it's that bad, we lock down. If it's not that bad, we need to manage it by a testing and a cleanliness process.
There's no right answers, is it, Paul? As I said, from your perspective and the sort of depth of your business and who your large customers are, you are directly impacted by, well, as everybody's, but probably more so by this sort of terrible situation.
Yeah. All the airlines looking at March, April next year now already. So the summer season's gone.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Christmas was historically quite busy. Obviously, people turning your fancy holidays, your Americas, your Barbados, people jetting to the Emirates on Boxing Day. We think that'll be gone. So they're already looking at March, April next year.
Assuming,
you know, we're heading for another spike, whether we want it or not. So we need to get to that period. And hopefully then we'll have a vaccine and we'll have a clear process for testing.
Well, we've just got to just hope for the best and fingers crossed. But as I say, you know, things do need to sort of return to some element of normality, however it is, because, you know, it's affecting everybody's livelihoods and businesses. But it's also, it's a terrible, horrible illness, isn't it? And, you know, epidemic.
No, it is. I'm not being flippant on that. And I probably sound like a word. You know, it's dreadful if one of your family members are affected, and we get that. And that's why we need processes and controls in place. But there has to be an exit point.
We've nearly done half an hour. Having a look around your sort of facility the other day, I mean, you've invested heavily on some very, very expensive vehicles. I can see that, you know, your vehicle carriers, your car, your transporters, your recovery vehicles. There's another sort of side to the business that I'm just quite intrigued to talk about. And I'm sure the listeners would be really, really interested as well, about supporting the film industry. Just tell me a little bit about that.
We do, yes. So again, that's more sort of Richard's side, if you like, because of his contacts in the past. But yeah, a lot of the films that you might see, whether it be sort of the Fast and Furious ones or the Mission Impossible ones, we help with the vehicle movements. So again, we've got vehicles at the moment over in Italy. We've got a lot of vehicles on the new Batman movie, whereby we have a lot of specialist whether it be HIABs or whether it be Formula One transport sort of coverage vehicles, and we'll move the vehicles from one set to another securely, safely, very privately, and basically move them around the world, but predominantly the UK and Europe. And it's just something that, as we invested heavily in our own fleet for recovery, we saw a marketplace whereby these assets, you know, a recovery truck might be 300 grand, but it might be sat there 20 hours a day. So you need to use that asset elsewhere. But that asset actually has a lot of use in the film industry, whether it be moving of props, moving of specialist vehicles, moving of damaged vehicles. So Richard's contacts with the studios, we've been able to get involved in an awful lot of sort of very high-profile films. We've got a new one starting in November, which I can't talk about, but we are on Batman at the moment. And they've been greatly affected by COVID, by the way, as well. But it's not glamorous. So, you know, people think, oh, it must be exciting that the lads are there moving vehicles from one set to the next. But it's a very sort of unique arm to our business. And it's something that not many people can do, because the way the film industry works is you have to react like that. So it's very much like the airline industry. So you'd think everything would be planned months ahead for filming. It sort of is, but it's not. You'll get a phone call in the morning and say, can we have three vehicles on site now? Because filming sort of timetables change, and you have to be able to drop everything, move those vehicles, take them on site. And that, again, is our skill set. We have a team of very dedicated drivers and recovery men who will work through the night, through the day, and make sure everything's on set at the right time. And then equally, when filming's cut, remove it. But, you know, with the covered car transporters, you'll never see a Batmobile driving down the M6, because it'll be in a secure Formula One coverage, which is our, you know, we've invested in that, and it just gives them, I think, the film studios some security that the vehicles are well maintained and looked after. And will be on site or set in this case as and when needed. But yeah, it's exciting. You know, we've got a few good ones coming up. And Batman's been a good one, even though it's been cut by COVID, because obviously we're from Liverpool, myself and Richard, so I've been filming in Liverpool pre-COVID, and they're going back to Liverpool in the next few weeks, on the basis that Liverpool looks like New York and Gotham's based on New York.
Yeah.
So it's quite nice to be doing something in your hometown, if you like, through the tunnels, by the library building. So it's very exciting, yeah.
It's great story. It's a great story. And I suppose ultimately the amount of investments you've made in the equipment you've got, you know, to be able to sort of sweat the asset and have it using doing other things is, you know, you think is rather a grand thing to be associated with the film industry. But when it's actually an asset that you own and you're working it, you're repurposing it to do something else, that's the key to working properly, isn't it? That's the key to logistics.
You've got to churn those hours. You know, a vehicle's no different to a man selling hours, isn't it? But you've got to have it in use. And no matter what that use is, that's fine. It just happens that it's quite interesting for the film industry.
And
I think that's a growth industry for us going forward. As much as we want aviation to come back, the UK is massive for films, for the film studios. It's huge. It's one of the biggest places in the world for filming. And we think we've got a great fleet of over 70 vehicles for the films. Trucks, vans, you know, HIABs, recovery vehicles, specialist transportation vehicles. You know, we are one of the biggest in the country of that, and we think for the next 5 years, particularly with COVID, because of the delay in films being made, and the digital stream. So, you know, Netflix is just as important as the cinema now, with all due respect. So Netflix, we do a lot of work on Netflix, creating films for them. It's a good growth area for us, and we're quite excited about that as well.
Again, it's a demonstration, I suppose, of clever business, really, you know, having different facets to the business, that when one goes quiet, the other one picks up, or you can move your skill set around your company as well, with, you know, keeping people gainfully employed. Paul, it's been absolutely brilliant, mate. I can't thank you enough for this. For CV Focus and for ITTHub.net will really sort of enjoy listening to it. But again, thanks for your time. We've done the half an hour. Perfect. Thank you very much for your time.
No, really appreciate it.
Next time I'm down around the sort of Heathrow Airport, I'll come and give you a knock, and we'll properly what is it, elbow bump at the minute, or what are we doing?
Yeah, whatever we're allowed to do at the time, we'll do. So that we'll observe social distancing. But yeah, next time you're down, it'd be good to show the facility again.
Excellent, mate. Thank you.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you.